Hello again and welcome back. For some 40 years, Esley Hamilton has been the most prominent voice locally in the cause of preserving historic property. As preservation historian for the St. Louis County Parks and Recreation Department, he has been tireless in advocating for recognizing and saving threatened historic property. He's retiring from his county post, but still plans to make his presence felt. Esley Hamilton joins me in studio to talk about his work and the challenges ahead. Esley, so nice to see you. Congratulations on your retirement. That's not quite a retirement.
Right. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor.
You're going to be involved, even though you have officially retired.
Right. We have a part-time position with the county parks, and I'll probably be doing that for the next year while we work on a new edition of our book, The Past and Our Present: Historic Buildings in St. Louis County. It's 20 years old, and we have a lot more information to add to it.
One of the things that you've said over the years, Esley, is that you think that St. Louis architecture has been and typically is underappreciated nationally. How so? Why?
Well, for one thing, a lot of the literature about the history of American architecture comes from the East Coast, and those people have not visited St. Louis, and so they often didn't include architects who were based here in St. Louis, even though we were the fourth largest city 100 years ago. And it's the AIA Guide to the Architecture of St. Louis, and then the recent book, American City, which have maybe 20 books or so. But there hasn't really been a scholarly work about the architecture of St. Louis since 1928.
Wow.
So that was John Albury Bryan's book, Missouri's Contribution to American Architecture. And so one of the things that our local Society of Architectural Historians chapter has done is publish original research, and that's all on our website, stlouisarchitecture.org. And over 15 years now, we've been able to add to that bibliography quite a bit.
We'll put a link to that website on our website at stlpublicradio.org. You know, somebody appreciates something about the building here in St. Louis, because I know all of the bricks in the city are finding their way down to New Orleans and places like that. I've never quite understood why. What is so special about those bricks?
Oh, well, actually, there was a movie made about St. Louis bricks, Bricks by Chance or Fortune, I think. And we do have very high-quality brick construction here. Many of them were made right in this area. The great poet T.S. Eliot's father was head of the largest brick company in St. Louis, the Hydraulic Press Brick Company.
And so why are they so valuable now in other places? What is it about the St. Louis brick that makes
Well, they're
it
probably
so
cheaper than new ones since they're coming from buildings that are being torn down.
Well, what happens, Esley, when we lose a historically significant building? What happens when that happens?
Well, we lose a little bit of our identity. And we're seeing that now with the struggle to save the Incarnate Word Convent in Bellnor. To most people, it's not the most important building architecturally, but to that community, it was a point of real pride. And visually, it also is kind of a linchpin of that whole community. And if they lose that, they're going to really have lost something significant to the community. And that's true of most historic buildings.
There has been sort of a stay of execution, if you will, for that Incarnate Word building. The university has decided to revisit that.
Yes, I think one thing is that the building is partly stone, so the cost of demolishing it may have taken them aback a little bit. But also, I think we have an issue with our state Historic Preservation Office. We would like to get it listed on the National Register of Historic Places, which would make it eligible for our state and federal tax credits, and that would make rehabilitation very feasible. Without that, it's very iffy.
Well, the university I'm referring to, obviously, is the University of Missouri, St. Louis, for
right.
folks who don't know that. It's an adjacent property. How do you feel about what's the word I want to use? You know, if they find an alternate alternative purpose for that building, make condos out of it or something, would that be a problem for you?
Oh, no. In fact, I should mention that I, all these years, have worked for the County Historic Buildings Commission, which goes back to 1957. It's the oldest government preservation body in the state of Missouri. And they really have directed my work. And their principle is that buildings should be adapted to new uses rather than torn down. It used to be, especially in the 19th century, once the original use was done, the building was immediately torn down. But we don't do that anymore because there are lots of ways to adaptively reuse buildings for economically viable use.
Does it cost more to preserve than to rebuild?
Quite the contrary. Mm-hmm. With the state and federal tax credits, it's much cheaper to rehabilitate a historic building than it is to build new. And that's one reason why we've seen so much rehabilitation in downtown St. Louis and very little new construction.
I think when folks are thinking about the architecturally significant buildings, they tend to think more of the city of St. Louis. But there is some property out in St. Louis County that fits the bill.
Yes, I think in addition to the kind of landmark buildings like the St. Vincent's Hospital, adjacent to our county, St. Vincent Park, which is a spectacular 1890s French chateau, former hospital. We have beautiful planned neighborhoods, and that's the greatest source of architectural richness in St. Louis County, especially beginning with the streetcar era. We had one community after another that was built to very high standards and significantly built for a range of income levels within the same neighborhood, like University Heights No. 1 and Parkview in University City. And my favorite example is Pasadena Hills off Natural Bridge Road, which is actually one of the last of those planned neighborhoods.
Well, when you draw the public's attention to things such as this, specific buildings or specific neighborhoods, what kind of response have you had to take over the year from politicians and from developers?
Well, it ranges. I think since we had the tax credit, developers are much more open to historic principles, and they've learned a lot about how to rehabilitate a building without ruining it. That was a big problem before also. Some people don't want anybody to tell them what to do with their property, period. And that's more a problem here in the Midwest than it is in the East, where many communities have had historic preservation laws for years, and that's just part of the environment of working. We're reaching that point now in the city of St. Louis because of the great diligent work of our Heritage Commission. But of the 90 municipalities in St. Louis County, only about 14 have any preservation commissions, and most of them are very weak. In Kirkwood, it's, for example, they're very conscious of their heritage, but they don't have the tools they need to save those buildings.
That surprises me, particularly in a place like Kirkwood, because that is in and of itself a historic spot.
Right. Well, their ordinance provides that they can delay demolition for 270 days, but they can't stop it. And all their design review is just voluntary.
We don't want to pick on Kirkwood necessarily, no. but could Kirkwood deal with that itself, or is some sort of state legislation required?
No. The state passed a very good enabling act in 1991, but many communities have not taken advantage of it. And also that 1991 law enables counties to have preservation commissions for the unincorporated areas. And our Buildings Commission has drafted legislation, which we hope to present to the county council later this year, that would cover the unincorporated parts of the county.
What does it tell you when the communities are reluctant or very slow to act in this area?
Well, it's very frustrating, and that's one reason why we've devoted so much time to education. In my heyday, which is a few years ago, I was giving more than 70 talks a year to civic groups to try to educate them to our resources and giving a lot of walking tours. And I do believe that that has, over the years, had a beneficial effect.
What do you think of the Paul McKee project in town? I mean, I know there's a very famous building there that's involved in this, the Clemens House.
Yeah.
But a lot of places are going to bite the dust, apparently, if this goes through. Your thoughts?
Well, this is kind of almost like a zombie rising from the grave of the urban renewal philosophy of the 1950s and 60s, which did so much damage to our inner cities. And my background is in urban planning, and I left urban planning for historic preservation because I thought that our we were ruining communities by clearing the buildings in the kind of naive hope that developers would come rushing in. And we're doing the same thing with Mr. McKee. He spent over $40 million of state funds buying up land, and he hasn't turned one shovel, as far as I know.
How well do you think you've done over the years? I mean, you've been, as I said in the introduction, tireless in your efforts. But you've had some hits and you've had some misses.
Oh, yeah. And I'm always thinking about the misses. And so it's been very gratifying in the last few years when people have said to me, well, no, you did some things right. Tom George mentioned, the chancellor of UMSL, that one reason why he's concerned about tearing down historic buildings is that the building may be gone, but the image of that building never goes away. He said they get about one call a week about why did you tear down the original Belle Reve Country Club building on the campus there. And that happened 30, 40 years ago. And that's true, I think, of the Coral Court Motel, which we really struggled to save in the early 90s at a period when that architecture wasn't as well appreciated as it is now. If that were still here, that would be a national tourist attraction.
Why do you think it's not here? Do you think its somewhat unsavory reputation had anything to do with it?
It did, because it was located in a small village of Marlborough. Many of the trustees of the village remembered when the building was first built, and all they could remember was the police calls and the other stories. They couldn't really see the architecture of the building for what it was. Especially complex of buildings.
For those of us in the audience who don't remember the Coral Courts, it was what we would call, I guess, a no-tell motel, where people would buy rooms by the hour. I guess that's the most delicate way to put it, correct?
Right. And when you say, why did we lose it? Well, our county parks department has been tireless in historic preservation. We have one of the finest collections of historic buildings of any county park system in the country. But when it came to the Coral Court, they couldn't really see purchasing that as a recreational facility.
For which it had been used extensively over the years. We have a limited time, but I want to get a couple of calls in if we can. We'll start with David calling from Webster Groves. David, you're on the air with Esley Hamilton.
Hi. I'm David from Webster, and I'm a Webster resident, and a little bit of shaming of my own city here. We have a historic church kind of on the northeast corner of Webster. It's on the registry, but you were talking earlier about how, you know, it's in everybody's interest if we can keep it and then somehow repurpose it. But it seems to be no matter what anyone proposes for that property to the city, it's just wholly unacceptable. So it's been sitting completely empty that I know of for about 15 years now, and we're really just watching it rot before our eyes, because anything anybody says they want to do with it, there's the famous phrase in Webster Groves, noise and traffic, and we're always against noise and traffic no matter what the other potential outcome is. And they propose condos, they propose like banquet centers, and if it involves any more cars in the neighborhood, they're just flat out against it. So we're literally watching this thing. It reminds me of the house that inspired Gatsby out on Long Island, where they literally just kind of opened up the windows and let the sea salt rot the entire building, and then the developer said, well, too bad, we can't do anything with it, it's got to be torn down now. And I'm afraid this property is headed down the same road just because the city seems to have boots of lead when it comes to this project.
You're talking about the old Disciples of Christ Church on Bompart, which I have...
Yeah, it's called a Jubilee Church, but yeah.
I have spoken many times about the importance of adapting that to it could be adapted for many other uses, including apartments, and for the neighbors there to say that would create too much traffic is ridiculous, because if the church were actually functioning, that would create much more traffic than a residential use would. And I think part of this goes back to having leaders, elected leaders, who have the gumption to actually take a stand instead of just backing off of every issue.
So Webster does not have this preservation organization.
Oh, they do. Webster Groves is one of the most active in historic preservation. Both their historical society and their city preservation commission have done tremendous work, but they have faced repeatedly these issues of NIMBYism, not in my backyard. There was another mid-century modern church on Big Bend that proposal was turned down just because people thought it would be too much traffic. And that was because they weren't used to the fact that the church might actually have traffic itself.
Speaking of churches, what about the Rock Hill Presbyterian Church at McKnight in Manchester? What's the status of it?
Well, that was torn down.
It was
and
torn
the
down.
Stones were moved to a location in another county, I believe. And whether it's going to be rebuilt, I don't know. But the stones weren't numbered, so it's not going to be the same building.
So that's
and
another.
That was another case where the city had a preservation commission, but they declined to designate that building or to defend it.
Let's talk about one of your hits. That would be Whitehaven. I remember back in the days when Gene McNary was county executive, when that was one of his missions, but you were right in the middle of that.
Yes, that's right. My boss, Virginia Stith, called the first meeting to see if it could be saved.
It's Julia Dent's, Ulysses Grant's wife's home.
Right, and today Whitehaven. It's Ulysses S. Grant National Historic Site. It's on Grant Road, just opposite Grant's Farm, and it attracts people from all over the country. They have done a magnificent job of restoring it. But back in the 80s, I was actually present when the owner died of a heart attack in the basement of the house. And thereafter, we were afraid that it was going to be developed for condos, the remaining 9 acres. Mm-hmm. So it was because the state and the city and the county, rather, and also some members of the family, the Wenslick family, who contributed to seeing that that was saved. And that was because of public activity. Elaine Veitz came in and hosted a huge party. Over 1,000 people came. After that, the politicians had to pay attention.
Elaine Veitz, of course, is the former columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
Right.
It came within a whisker of going.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. You mentioned parks a couple of moments ago, and parks are things that have to be preserved as well. And I know you're right in the middle of something now concerning a park that folks have their eyes on to expand, the Jefferson Barracks Cemetery.
Yes, that's Sylvan Springs Park, which is part of the original Jefferson Barracks reservation. It's a 70-acre site that was actually built as a park by the Army in 1939 for Army soldiers, and it was used during World War II as a place for USO troops. Judy Garland sang there and all the other big names. And it was purchased by the county in 1950 when Jefferson Barracks was closed as a U.S. Army base. So it's an important part of our military history as it is. Of course, I'm opposed to ever selling parkland because I believe it's a public trust. When people vote for the bond issues to allow us to purchase this land, it's not for temporary use. It's for future generations. But in this case, it's particularly outrageous because this will not solve the cemetery's problems. They need to have a larger cemetery that will last for the next 100 years, Jefferson Barracks Cemetery Number 2. And this is part of what we've seen over the last 5 years since our Historic Buildings Commission has been involved in this, how the Veterans Administration does not like to face these big issues. They've done it with their hospitals, and they're doing it with their cemeteries. We've got to get our congressional delegation to back purchasing a real solution to our space problems.
But where would it come from at Jefferson Barracks if you don't go to the park? Where would the land come from?
Well, it could be anywhere. It could be in Jefferson County. Some people have proposed beautiful sites overlooking the Mississippi River. It could be on the Illinois side, on the bluffs, which would also have beautiful views. It could be something that's really nice. But to nickel and dime, the way they're doing is not a service to anyone.
That's the key, and I suspect a lot of people aren't thinking that way, that they are thinking that it has to be contiguous to the existing cemetery.
Well, there's even land contiguous to the cemetery on the south side where there's a Melville School, which they are already considering selling to a developer. They could be selling that property to the cemetery.
Esley, as we indicated at the beginning of the program, you're going to be hanging around for a while, even in spite of your retirement, 20 hours a week or something like
yeah.
that. And your successor, Danny Gonzalez.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about him, and is he of the same ilk as you?
Well, Danny, sorry he can't be here. He's doing his civic duty on jury duty today. But his background is in history. He's from Indiana, but he's worked at the History Museum here, and for the last 2 years he's been the curator at Jefferson Barracks. His interest is more the historical associations of buildings rather than my background in architecture. But I think it's also an equally valid approach. And he's very energetic and very personable.
Well, with his association with Jefferson Barracks, we only have 45 seconds left. How is he going to come down on this whole Sylvan Park controversy over the expansion?
It's what the Historic Buildings Commission wants to do, but okay. they are very adamant about this.
Biggest challenge ahead for him?
Well, that and I think just keeping the momentum going for all the wonderful groups that we work with in historic preservation in this area.
Well, and you're going to be around to see to it that he knows who all the players are and introduce them to those folks. Esley Hamilton, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a joy to talk to you, and your enthusiasm for what you do is very infectious. And
well, thank you.
People love that in a person. Thanks so much for being with us, and good luck to you in your semi-retirement. I guess that's what we have to call.
Yes, thanks.
Right. Esley Hamilton. That's it for us today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with St. Louis City Board of Aldermen President Lewis Reed about the just-concluded session and other issues, including a proposal to raise the minimum wage. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.